This year is intended to be a quick review of the past 2 years of learning Ezra and Nehemiah. Obviously, there's a lot of material that I'm going to be skipping. We have 59 shiurim on it. But hopefully this will hit some of the highlights. And my plan is to do a brief introduction and then just to go parak by parak, chapter by chapter, hitting some of the points that we looked at. So we started by looking at the history before Sefer Ezra, before the book of Ezra begins. And the picture that we painted is that our exile and our return to the land are not functions of geopolitics, but they are of divine will. They are divinely orchestrated. So that we find that the Jews go into Galut, they go into exile because of their sins. That's the way that Tanakh presents the picture very clearly. It's not simply a matter of one nation deciding to invade another nation, but go all the way back to the time of King Chizkiyahu when he's supposed to be Mashiach, as described in the 11th parak, 11th chapter of Yeshaya. But Chizkiyahu fails. He shows the stores of the Beit HaMikdash to his enemies as part of trying to build an alliance with them. Hashem responds by exiling ultimately Yehuda and Yisrael. The Jews are exiled because of their sins, and they're told that they're going to return. Yirmiyahu predicts that after 70 years of exile, we're going to return. And Hashem predicts it from the start. If you look at Yeshaya, the 44th chapter, 45th, God predicts the arrival of Koresh, of Cyrus, before the exile has ever happened. He's already calling the shot that we're going to return under Koresh, and indeed at the end of Divrei Hayamim, we're told about the Jews' return to Israel under the Persian king Koresh. That's a little bit of background. The books of Ezra and Nehemiah, which, are originally one book, it's just the book of Ezra in all our classic sources, they inform us about the history of the Jews' return to the land, but they're really not history books. It's missing a lot of significant description you would need if it were truly a history book. Really, it's about presenting the milestones of the national return to Israel and the construction of the second Beis HaMikdash. The Kuzari makes this point in Chilek Gimel, Samach Gimel, explaining that Tanakh doesn't really record the details of people's lives. It records central public moments. There also is an element of legitimizing the Jews of the Second Temple, the Second Beit HaMikdash, as a revival of what we had in the first one. So those themes are really important. The milestones of our national return and legitimizing the construction of the Second Beit HaMikdash as a revival of the first. In terms of the Persian kings of that time, the books will introduce us to 3.5 Persian kings. First, Cyrus II, also known as Cyrus the Great, conqueror of the Babylonians, who is the one who sends us to build the Beit HaMikdash. Then we get Darius the Persian, King Darius, Daryavesh, and that's in Ezra chapters 4 to 6. He is the one who will allow the building to continue, overriding objections of the Samaritans. We'll talk about the Samaritans later. You get a very brief one sentence that mentions King Ahasuerus of Persia in Ezra chapter 4, sentence 6. He is very unclear in terms of who he is and when he lives. If you listen to the classes that we had on the fourth chapter of Ezra, you'll also be confused. And that's my half king when I say 3.5. And then you have King Artaxasta of Persia. And Artaxasta is the one who sends Ezra and then later sends Nehemiah. And technically there may be more than one Artaxasta, multiple kings operating under that name. We spent enough time going through that debate. If we were to work with the secular chronology, the secular history, we would probably say that Koresh is Cyrus II, Darius is Darius I, Ahasuerus is Xerxes, and Artaxasta is Artaxerxes. Some will disagree with various associations, especially the association of Ahasuerus with Xerxes. Okay. We spent a lot of time trying to match up the kings that are found in Ezra and Nehemiah with the Persian kings recorded in history. I am certainly not going to reopen this, but if you take a look at the classes from the sixth chapter in Nehemiah, the sixth chapter in Ezra, you'll find more material. The first generation of Jews who return are led first by Sheish Batzar, who is the political leader of Judea at the outset of their return. He's a descendant of David HaMelech. Then we get Zerubbabel mentioned. Zerubbabel returns from Babel. He is a political leader of the Jews in Judea as of the third parak in Ezra. He seems to be replacing Sheish Batzar. He may also be Nehemiah. We'll have to talk about that. He is a descendant of the Davidic dynasty. Then you have Yeshua ben Yehotzadak, or Yeshua ben Yehotzadak. He is Kohen Gadol when the altar, the Mizbeach, is first built for the second Beit HaMikdash. Ibn Ezra in Haggai suggests that Yeshua ben Yehotzadak is chosen because Yehotzadak was a Kohen Gadol at the end of the first Beit HaMikdash. And so that's part of the authenticity. Look, we have continuity from the Kohen and Gadolim of the first Beit HaMikdash. Ezra and Nehemiah aren't there in the beginning, at least not explicitly. They only show up later. Although, as I said, we're going to see some association between at least Nehemiah and Zerubbabel. Okay, that's all. 5-minute introduction. The books begin. Ezra, Perek Aleph, Perek Bet, the first two chapters of Ezra, present our return to our land. Chapter 1, Cyrus sends us home. Based on historical evidence, it seems that Cyrus didn't think he was sending us home. Cyrus thought he was executing a political strategy. The historians have found, or archaeologists have found, the Cyrus cylinder in which he declares he is restoring Babylon after conquering them, and he is supporting the temples of Marduk, because Marduk had rejected Nabonides, the Babylonian king. So he makes himself the new anointed of the Babylonians. It's a smart strategy, right? Rather than try the classic approach of dominating populations and dealing with rebellions, and rather than try the Assyrian method of population transfer, he just says, look, I'll be their friend. What's not to like? And it's clear within Tanakh that he doesn't think he's doing what Hashem wants him to do. Yeshaya, Perek Mem Hei, chapter 45, sentences 4 and 5, make it very clear that he, quote, does not know God. So what motivates him as far as Tanakh is concerned? Well, the psukim themselves, the verses themselves say, Heir Hashem et Rucho. God awakened his spirit. It's Hashem who's moving him to do it. It's all part of Hashem's plan for Koresh, who is his anointed one, and for the conclusion of our 70-year exile. There are all sorts of parallels in our return to Yitziat Mitzrayim, to when we left Egypt, like in the divine control of the king who sends us out, as well as the gifts that are given by non-Jewish neighbors. That's Perek Aleph. That's chapter 1. Then in chapter 2, you get extensive name lists detailing various groups of Jews of different lineages, different roles, and we get various explanations for why these name lists are reproduced here in Ezra, and we're going to see them in Ezra, we're going to see more of them in Nehemiah. One answer was that this is the style of biblical poetry. Another answer offers two contradictory approaches. Either, by listing everybody, you make the returnees look like a large group, or alternatively, by showing you can list them in this chapter, you make the returnees look like a small group. Okay. Another answer is that these are the nobility of the new land. They're the ones who are going to bring various korbanot. We'll see later on in Nehemiah that they bring the wood offerings every year. Their families bring the wood offerings for the Beis HaMikdash. These will also include the villains, for that matter. So you're setting the stage and listing all of the big figures. Rabbi Angel, in an essay on the name list, suggests, or Chaim Angel, suggests that it's trying to emphasize the importance of the people rather than the structure. And this is an idea found in the writings of Tamar Cohen Ashkenazi as well. It's trying to emphasize the people, so we list all of the people. Another answer, based on the Gemara in Kiddushin, and I think this is the simplest answer, is that it's establishing the lineage of who can marry whom in the fallout of the exile. And I say it's the simplest because, after all, the text actually goes to the trouble of identifying the different groups and who can marry whom. It makes a lot of sense. Last answer was suggested, actually, when I taught Ezra on Yom Kippur at the Bayit, so Jared, offer the following suggestion, that it mirrors the censuses when we leave Egypt, meaning the Chumash has censuses of the Jewish people when in the Midbar, in the wilderness, so here we get a census as well, and that would be part of the pattern of mirroring Yitziat Mitzrayim. I like the idea very much, that it's mirroring what happened when we left Egypt. Okay, but those are your first two chapters. Cyrus sends us home, and we get the lists of the Jews who return home. Then Ezra chapters 3 and 4 depict our first steps in our new land. So in the beginning of chapter 3, we build a new mizbeach. We build an altar together. We don't do it right away, maybe because we needed to start farming first, developing a livelihood first. That was Malbim's approach. Or because of hostile neighbors we are afraid of, we need to get everybody together. But the timing works out for us to dedicate it at the time of Sukkot, which is like Shlomo's dedication of the first temple, the first Beit HaMikdash, which was on Sukkot. This event, the building and dedication of the Mizbeach, seems to be mirrored in Nehemiah chapter 7. Meaning, we're going to seem to see the same event there, which may be part of what leads the Gemara to identify Nehemiah with Zerubbabel. In other words, what we're saying is, what you see described with Nehemiah in Nehemiah chapter 7 is actually the same thing as what happens with Zerubbabel. In Ezra chapter 3, it's just telling the story from history, and Nehemiah equals Zerubbabel. Okay. After that, they start building the Beit HaMikdash. They start to build in the month of Iyar, which is important also, because Shlomo started to build the first Beit HaMikdash in Iyar. So now that we have an altar, it's time to build the building. We're going to do it the way Shlomo did it. There is a mix, although Shlomo... Yeah, leave that. There's a mix of joy and disappointment, because what they're building now does not match the glory of the first Beit HaMikdash, as noted here, as noted in Haggai as well. In chapter 4, still part of this theme of our first steps in the new land, we have trouble with our neighbors. The neighbors are the Samaritans. Who are the Samaritans? So for this you go back to Malachim Bet, Kings 2, chapter 17. The northern kingdom, the kingdom of Yisrael, had split off from the southern kingdom already in the generation after Shlomo HaMelech, after King Solomon, and they had descended fairly rapidly into idolatry and into corruption. Well, they get invaded by the Assyrians. And the Assyrian method, as we mentioned earlier, is to replace populations they conquer with other populations. Certainly helps in terms of making sure that a population doesn't have the spirit of defending their homeland. When they fight you, when they revolt, they also aren't as rooted in the place. They don't know the territory. They don't have the alliances. So that's what the Assyrians do here. There are some members of the 10 tribes who remain, but basically they replace the bulk of the 10 tribes with tribes from elsewhere who are centered. Their capital is in Shomron, Samaria, hence the name Samaritans, also often called Kutim because many of them came from a place called Kuta. Well, they worship idolatry. They're attacked by lions. They say, uh-oh, what's going on? It's because we're worshiping idols. The god of this land does not want us to worship idols. And the Assyrians import Kohanim to teach the locals how to practice Judaism. The Gemara in Kiddushin, Ayin Dalet, Ayin Hey, has a debate about the status of this Jewish practice that they develop and whether they actually converted to Judaism, whether we would recognize that halachically. Either way, you get to Ezra chapter 4, and they see the Jews building the Beis HaMikdash, and they say, oh, we want to build it with you. Our leadership rejects that offer. Rashi says we reject the offer because they wanted to sabotage the process from the inside. We knew they were trying to damage the process. They didn't want to help. Malbim says the reason is because they wanted to build it as a hybrid for Judaism and Avodah Zarah. Both of these views can be supported within the Gemara. If I remember correctly, it was the Gemara in Erchin, which during the original class on this, we talked about how you could support both views. Bottom line is that the Samaritans are rejected, but they will persist with diplomatic and physical harassment of the project. And here we get an example of diplomatic harassment. They appeal to King Artaxerxes in Persia. And again, according to some, this is an illustration of their obstruction, but it's transplanted from later in history, which makes sense, because they appeal to Artaxerxes saying the Jews are building the walls of Jerusalem, and once they have their walls built, they're going to stop paying you tribute. That makes no sense at this stage. The Jews are not building the walls. They're building the Beis HaMikdash. They're building the temple. This is an easily falsifiable claim. It's obvious that what they're saying is not true. So that leads some to say, and some say, no, they're actually, that's the point, is that they're trying to cheat in order to anger Artaxerxes. Look, they're building defenses. And according to this approach, they bribe people to convey an incorrect message to Artaxerxes. Alternatively, this event actually is transported from later in our history when they were building the walls, and it's just here as an example of Samaritan opposition. The problem with that view, if it really is transplanted, is that it's very unclear then how this works with the chronology in Ezra chapters 5 and 6. that where they resume building the first Beis HaMikdash, the first temple. It sounds like it's an outgrowth of this. Nonetheless, the Samaritans make their argument to King Artaxasta via royal scribes, Shimshi and Rehum, saying we're going to rebel against the king. The king investigates and agrees with their argument, and he halts the construction for a period of time until King Darius is the one to restart the construction. That brings us to Ezra 5 and 6. In Ezra 5 and 6, the rebuilding continues. It's the second year of King Darius. Haggai and Zechariah, the Nevi'im, charge the Jews with continuing to build. And there's no apparent opposition from the home base in Persia, and the Samaritans don't seem to do anything about it. Now we're building the Beis HaMikdash, we're building the temple again. If that story from earlier is actually a later story, then apparently there must have been some kind of halting to the construction of the Beis HaMikdash also, just not what's reported in Ezra chapter 4. Well, the Persian governor, Tatnai, comes through on a supervisory visit. He sees the building, and he demands to see their papers. He says, where's your permit? Now, you could look at Tatnai as hostile, or as a government agent who's just doing his job. Either way, they don't have the papers. We lost our papers. So Tatnai says, you can keep on building. I'm riding away to headquarters, though, to ask them what to do. So at headquarters, they go looking for the permit. And lo and behold, the Persian archives in Madai, in Media, yield a document which has their permit and is actually more elaborate than what we saw in chapter 1 in its description of how the Jews should build the Beis HaMikdash, how they should build the temple. And Darius reads the document. He orders Tatnai have the construction proceed immediately, and he is very supportive personally. He's very generous. Why is he so supportive? Well, some suggest that he is the son of Esther and Ahasuerus. Could be he's just trying to avoid revolts. The Persians have trouble elsewhere, don't need a mess in Judea. It could be he did it to honor his predecessor Cyrus, who started the project. It could be he's selfish. There are views in the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, Daf Gimel Daf Dala, that try to read him that way, that he's doing it for his own benefit. He wants them to pray on his behalf. Or it could really just be an extension of what we already saw regarding Cyrus, where we said that Hashem was Heir Rucho. Hashem raised his spirit to do this. It could be Hashem did the same thing and manipulated Dayavish. Why didn't he manipulate Artaxasta then? Good question. Well, the construction continues, and aspects of it mirror the first Beis HaMikdash, aspects of how the dimensions of the materials and so on. The Beis HaMikdash is built, it's dedicated, it's the sixth year of King Darius, there's a big dedication party, there are many korbanot, and then we discuss that, is there a chatas, is there a sin offering involved, not for right now, and they hold a major korban Pesach. They have a major celebration of Pesach, and we noted, based on the comments in the Da Mikra commentary, that this seems to correct some of the problems from Chizkiah's great celebration back in his day when he celebrated Pesach. Because here the nation rallies, and they do it in purity, and they do it on the right date. Ah, now we got it right. By the way, one insight I forgot to mention for why Darius is supportive is the idea that he is establishing, this one we're going to see in a couple of minutes, it's going to come back to us, but he's establishing the Beis HaMikdash as a Persian government building. It's really going to be part of the Persian system, and we'll see in a moment where that fits in. But that's Ezra 5 and 6. The rebuilding has continued, and the rebuilding is completed. Then in chapter 7 and 8, Ezra shows up, late to his own book. He needed everything first, but Ezra doesn't show up until now, it seems. Ezra is known to King Artaxasta as a righteous teacher of Torah in Babel, in Babylon, and that's clear from the letter that the king gives Ezra. His father, or maybe grandfather, Sariah, was a Kohen Gadol. The Medrash is brought in the Gemara Megillah Tezayin Amud Beis, says that Ezra stayed in exile to learn from Baruch ben Neriah, who was the scribe of Yirmiyahu. But Ezra has been very active in Babel. The Gemara in Kiddushin, as we mentioned before, credits him with sorting out the lineages, Kiddushin Ayin Amar Aleph, that he actually was the one who sorted out all the lineages of who could marry whom that we then documented when they came under Zerubbabel. That business of sorting out the lineages is going to be very important when we get to the end of Sefer Ezra. Okay, so Ezra has a major public role. Ezra is introduced here with 15 generations of his lineage, which underscores his importance. He is a sofer, which can mean scholar, but he is credited in our material, in our tradition, as a scribe, establishing the alphabet we would use, establishing the text of the Torah. He establishes public Torah study, which is going to relate to something that's going to happen in Nehemiah. He frames public policy and halacha with takanos, with enactments. According to the Rambam in his introduction to the Arach HaZaka, Ezra served as Kohen Gadol at some point, although that's really not seen in Ezra and Nehemiah. And in fact, in Nehemiah we have a list of the Kohanim Gedolim, and Ezra is not listed on the list, so I'm not really clear about that. Okay. In any case, Artaxasta gives Ezra the keys to the kingdom. He gives him outsized financial support directly, meaning direct gifts, and via the right to take from the local tax collection. He gives him a mission of teaching the law of God in the area and imposing it as law recognized by the Persian government. He exempts all who work in the Beit HaMikdash from taxes, and this goes back to my point that that it's like a Persian government building, and he has the right to carry out any punishment, including capital punishment. Ezra comes with about 1,800 men. Professor Salo Baron is quoted in the Dot Mikra commentary as extrapolating that that means about 9,000 people. Okay. They gather in Bavel on the first of Nisan, obvious symbolism with Yitzias Mitzrayim, with getting out of Egypt. The first of Nisan is the day when they gather to leave Bavel. Ezra rallies some Levim, but he doesn't have that many. And the Gemara in Yevamos, based on the what's going to happen in Nehemiah, we'll see it when we get there. The Gemara in Yevamos Peivav says that Ezra punishes the Levim by taking away their claim to Maaser Rishon and giving it to either the Kohanim or the Aniim. Ezra holds a big public prayer. He says, I don't want to ask the king for a protective escort. He could have one, but he doesn't want to ask for it because he's already told the king, Hashem protects his followers. So they're going to go without the escort. They arrive in the month of Av. There's obvious symbolism here, reversing their mourning of the month of Av from the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash to Simcha, to joy, like in Zechariah chapter 8, converting the fast days to joy. Also worth noting that there's an Ezra-Aharon connection here because the first of Av is Aharon's yard site. So Ezra shows up, the descendant of Aharon, here in the beginning of Av. They deliver gifts to the Beis HaMikdash. They bring a new round of korbanot, including a korban chata to atone for Avodah Zarah that was worshipped in the first Beis HaMikdash, according to the Gemara in Horios, Dav Vav Amud Aleph. Okay, that's chapter 7 and 8. Ezra shows up. They bring gifts. They bring korbanot. And then the last two chapters of Ezra focus on the problem of intermarriage. We noted that Malachi chapter 2 has the theme of intermarriage as well. That may be what helps the Gemara Megillah Tezvav identify Malachi with Ezra. Intermarriage is viewed as a betrayal of Jewish spouses and a betrayal of God. There is a view that marriage to everybody but the seven Canaanite nations was only rabbinically prohibited. And that the seven Canaanite nations are the only ones who are biblically prohibited. But that's really awkward to support in Ezra chapters 9 and 10. It sure sounds like there's a pre-existing prohibition. They come reported to Ezra that it's going on. Ezra's very upset. Like, it doesn't sound like this is something he's going to create. The events here seem to be 4 months after Ezra arrived. According to Rashi on Malachi, the intermarriage he's talking about is happened in Bavel. But the context here, and in Medrash and Bereishis Rabba Yudches Hey, has the intermarriage happening in Israel. The people who Ezra just sifted all of their yichus, he got everything arranged, those are the ones who are now marrying among the Canaanim. Yeah, and not only that, but the text sounds like the leaders are the ones who are guilty of it. How can that happen? So it could be like the time of the Shoftim, where indeed we have problematic leaders. It could be that the leaders thought that it's just the Canaanite tribes who are prohibited. Rav Yosef Kahaneman, though, in a letter to David Ben-Gurion, part of the letters on who is a Jew and how to determine Jewish identity, says that he thinks the leaders did this on purpose. The leaders thought it was necessary to build up the meager Jewish population by marrying among the non-Jews. Okay. Ezra, for his part, hears this news and he acts out avelos, mourning. He fasts, he prays to God an apology, he does not threaten punishment, even though he's been licensed with that authority. the nation gathers to Ezra. There's a leader, Shechaniah ben Yechiel, who, like Pinchas, says, we've sinned, we have to separate from our non-Jewish wives. He's going to stand up and make the stand that Ezra is not willing to make. No option of conversion is proposed here, just separation. So the secular view is, because there's no such thing as organized conversion at this point in history. However, you don't really need to say that. It's that conversion is not indicated here. As Ibn Ezra says, you don't have righteous people here. How in the world could you convert the people who are going to be married to them? Rav Meidan argues that even if anybody was sincere at this point, Ezra would have excluded them anyway because the nation is so weak. Well, the nation turns to Ezra to lead. So he says, okay, separate, but he only mentions separating the non-Jewish wives, not the non-Jewish husbands. Why is that? So the truth of the matter is that Ezra elsewhere will say, don't marry either direction, non-Jewish men or non-Jewish women. And in Perek Yud, Pasuk Yud Aleph, chapter 10, sentence 11, his language is not about a particular gender. So there really may be no issue here. It really could be he's speaking to both. However, there are a few answers. One answer is, Abarbanel says, only the Jewish men intermarried. That's a really hard thing to say. In the Shir, Elisheva suggested something interesting. She suggested that maybe Sefer Ezra is being delicate, not mentioning the case of the Jewish woman married to the non-Jewish husband so as to avoid offending the Persians. Ahasuerus or his descendants, the non-Jew married to a Jewish woman. But I think that Shaya Cohn's answer, Professor Cohn, his answer to me fits in very well just on a practical level, which is that the women who married non-Jewish men moved out to be with their husbands. That was the way things worked. So they're not on the scene. Ezra's talking to the Jews, and among the Jews you have men who married non-Jewish women, and that's what he specifies here, that they have to separate. Ezra finally uses his royally assigned power now to confiscate property from those who don't comply. Although the Gemara doesn't view it as royally assigned power, the Gemara views this as a precedent for the principle of Hefker Beit Din, that rabbinical courts can indeed take away people's property. So the people bring a special ram offering. They separate from their intermarriages. It's unclear why they brought this ram offering. Is it required? Is it a special ruling for that time? We discussed that in the Shir. The nation at this point has clearly come a long way since arriving in the land. We're now at the end of Sefer Ezra. They have a Mizbeach, they have a Beis HaMikdash, they have serious power, but they also have problems, including intermarriage. And there's a debate as to whether Ezra succeeds in separating all the intermarriages at that time or not. But even if he did succeed, more is coming in Sefer Nehemiah. Okay, that is Ezra. Now let's talk Nehemiah. So Nehemiah chapters 1 and 2 present the arrival of Nehemiah. Again, as we said at the start of Ezra, this is all one book, Ezra and Nehemiah. Later on, the church separates it out, and you find that that our commentators follow suit and break it out separately. The Chida famously says that Nehemiah has finished his kapara, his atonement. The reason why he was originally folded into Ezra, as we're going to see, is that he's criticized for something he does in chapter 5, and so therefore he is robbed of having his name on the book. So the Chida says, by a certain point in history, he had atoned, and therefore the book could again be called on his name. Either way, in the Gemara's day, it's just Sefer Ezra. Rashi just calls it Sefer Ezra. That's the way it was into the period of the Rishonim. In any case, Nehemiah is a servant of King Artaxasta. Now, I mentioned already before, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Lamed Zayin, Lamed Ches, identifies Nehemiah with Zerubbabel. And I think what it's trying to do is to solve two problems. Number one, Ezra was introduced with 15 generations of lineage. Nehemiah gets zero reference here. No lineage whatsoever. He's just Nehemiah. But number two, and more seriously, the Ezra chapter 3, Nehemiah chapter 7 problem. The fact that the events of Ezra chapter 3, where they're building the Mizbeach, seem to appear in Nehemiah chapter 7 as well, but in Ezra chapter 3, Ezra and Nehemiah are not mentioned by name, but if they're present by other names, then all works. And so you get perhaps the idea that Ezra is Sheshbatzar, I didn't mention that before, but that goes along with this, that Ezra is Sheshbatzar and Nehemiah is Zerubbabel. They were there before. Maybe they left and then came back later on. It would also help explain why they didn't show in the beginning. Okay. So, Nehemiah starts out as a key member, and at least in explicit reference in the book of Nehemiah, as a key member of the court of Persian King Artaxasta. He is the cupbearer of the king, which sounds like a servant, but it's actually a high-ranking position. He becomes a leader in building the walls of Yerushalayim. And he becomes involved in religious leadership as well. And he will have many, many enemies. He's going to face many foes. As a matter of fact, see the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Kuf Gimel Amud Beis, for more on that. And his relationship with God is front and center in this book. Even though he's a very practical, get things done type of a leader, nonetheless, he is decidedly religious in his presentation. Sanhedrin Tzadi Gimel mentions him not getting his own book originally, and that's the source for the criticism of him because of his comments in Nehemiah chapter 5, where he's going to congratulate himself at one point. Reading the self-congratulation, I think there are explanations that can be given for why he does it. Most clear to me is the approach taken in Encyclopedia Mikra'id, volume 5, page 820, which suggests that his personal account and his statement about all the things he did is meant to justify himself against his detractors and his enemies, who we have already mentioned above. So he's not looking to aggrandize himself, he's looking to defend himself. But we'll see that as we go through the particular cases. Either way, in chapter 1 of Nehemiah, Hanani brings word that Yerushalayim is destroyed, its walls are burned. This sounds like a planned meeting. Nehemiah is keeping tabs on what's happening in Israel. It's interesting that Josephus presents it as a chance meeting. Just happened to be, but the language of our book really doesn't think so. Josephus is in Antiquities of the Jews, 11:5-6. So Josephus presents it at random, and I wonder if it's not because Josephus has an agenda. He wants to portray Jews in the court as loyal. If you look at Abarbanel on Daniel, he points that out within Josephus. So it could be that he's afraid of the appearance of a fifth column in the king's court. He doesn't want it to look like Nebuchadnezzar. He doesn't want it to look like Nehemiah was plotting, and so therefore he says it's a chance meeting. Either way, Hanani says Yerushalayim is in ruins, its walls are burned. The conventional read is that this is new destruction. That's what Malbim says. The walls are still in ruins from the Churban, from when the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, but now there are new assaults. And that's one way to read it. If you play with the chronology of Ezra chapter 4 and the Samaritan opposition and so on, you could play games with it a little bit and say they started building the walls earlier and now they're in ruins and that's what he's talking about. Could be. Fine. So Nehemiah davens to Hashem. He relies heavily on prayers from elsewhere in Tanakh, much like Daniel, who in Daniel chapter 9, sentences 14 to 19, also davens and uses lines from prayers from elsewhere in Tanakh. So too, Nehemiah does that. He chiefly uses lines from Moshe in Sefer Devarim and from Shlomo in Melachim Aleph Perek Chet, which is important because Shlomo will resurface at the end of Nehemiah as well as a key figure in Nehemiah's mind. So in Nehemiah chapter 2, Nehemiah approaches Artaxerxes and gets permission to build. Now, this is really surprising if I take the view that Ezra 4 occurred in the book of Ezra, in other words, before this event here. Because that means that Artaxerxes, this Artaxerxes or another one, actually stopped the construction because of Samaritan opposition, and now Nehemiah is going to get permission to build. It's interesting. In any case, Nehemiah davens, then he speaks to the king. The king asks him, you know, you look upset. That's his own story. Go back to our shiurim on the parak in order to understand more about that. But the king goes along with it. Now, you could say the king goes along with it out of affection for Nehemiah, which is Ibn Ezra's approach. It could be that it's, again, because the Persians are busy. They have the Greeks, they're dealing with the Egyptians. But the Navi himself, Nehemiah, Nehemiah, chapter 2, sentence 8, credits the decision of Artaxerxes to Hashem. God moves the pieces, as we saw with Cyrus. We are then introduced to Sanballat and Tobiah. Sanballat is Nehemiah's chief opponent, known to us via papyri from a place called Yev, that's now called Elephantine. He's not just known to us from the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. And we're introduced to Tobiah, who's going to be a thorn in Nehemiah's side all through the book. Maybe Jewish, likely not Jewish, as we'll talk about. So Sanballat and Tobiah are not happy that the Jews have permission to build their walls. Then Nehemiah arrives. He does a clandestine survey of the ruined wall. Why does he do it in secret? So it could be because of fear of the enemy and of sabotage. However, Rashi adds this very interesting additional layer based on a word that's used in describing Nehemiah's actions, the word shover. Rashi says that Nehemiah actually damages the wall more when his circuit that he tries to make around the city in order to increase people's support for the rebuilding project. Well, Nehemiah is dismissive of the opposition of Sanballat, Tobia, as well as Geshem HaRavi. He says, make your case to Shushan if you like, but I'm going ahead. Okay, so chapters 1 and 2, Nehemiah finds out what's happening and arrives. Chapter 3 and 4, we get the battle to build. Perek Gimel, chapter 3 of Nehemiah, focuses on a detailed map of the wall as Nehemiah leads the rebuilding. Each segment of the wall is built under the aegis of a particular group. The Perek spends a lot of time on who built each section, maybe as a way to honor the foremen, that they're the leaders of the construction. Maybe it's just honoring the builders. They should be remembered well. Maybe Nehemiah is just trying to show you, look, this is how you get a project done. Unclear. It appears from the Gemara in Shavuos Tezayin, as well as the map in the Dan Mikra edition, that they expand the city northward. Why north? Likely to add a buffer, because that's the most vulnerable side of the city. That's how Yerushalayim gets attacked, so they want to add some protection. Nehemiah does not have the Ezra-style pep talk. He just gets them to go ahead and do it. The enemy responds with psychological warfare, trying to undermine morale. That's all they can really do, because they can't oppose Nehemiah directly. However, in Chapter 4, they get more into the open. Maybe out of desperation and rage, but they're more direct in their planned attacks. Nehemiah davens, and then he takes the practical step of setting up defenses. Chapter 4, sentence 6 is an awkward sentence. It's unclear whether it's saying Nehemiah maybe had data on the impending attacks from Jews who have been forced to work for the Samaritans in their attacks. That may be what's going on there. We then take a break from the wall. Nehemiah chapter 5, we learn about economic order. There are two major elements found in this parak. First of all, the theme of the leader, Nehemiah in this case, looking after the basic needs of the population, like Moshe, like a melech, a king. But for a leader to take the kind of direct initiative Nehemiah takes here is rare. Maybe the example is Tzidkiyahu when he forces the freeing of slaves in Yirmiyahu chapter 34, but that's not really that successful. He frees them and then they go back. But that's one theme here, is the leader looking after the basic needs of the population. The other is the difficult relationship between Jewish leaders and wealth, because we find a lot of discomfort with Nehemiah's own wealth, and he feels the need, as we'll see, to defend himself, to defend his wealth. I didn't take anything from the community, and so on. There's a lot of tension in that regard. So what actually happens? The people come to Nehemiah and outline their financial suffering. They're starving, they've mortgaged their land, they've taken on big debts to be able to pay the king's taxes, they've sold their children into slavery. Nehemiah offers a big public rebuke for those who have been taking advantage of the vulnerable, and then he abolishes the debts. Ibn Ezra suggests it's Shemitah, so maybe it's not entirely unprecedented for him to do so. But Nehemiah begins with his own holdings, and then he defends his own finances. I didn't take public funds. I could have taken it, but I did not do so. And there's this defensiveness about what he has that I mentioned before. When he praises himself, I think what he's really doing is simply warding off a specific attack. Okay. Then, Nehemiah Perek Vav, chapter 6. And now we have assaults that are much more direct on Nehemiah. Nehemiah faces both physical threats and charges of disloyalty to the throne, as did others in this era. I mean, physical threats, the kings of the northern kingdom had them all the time. Ahasuerus was nearly assassinated, right? Gedalia, of course, got assassinated. The idea of charges of disloyalty are also common. The Jews are charged with disloyalty by Haman. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are charged with disloyalty for not bowing when the music plays in the third parak of Daniel. Daniel is charged with disloyalty to Daryavesh Hamadi in Daniel chapter 6. That's how he gets thrown in the lion's den. So this is not new, this idea. But there is this charge that Nehemiah is trying to revolt against the king, much as we saw claimed in Ezra chapter 4. And it plays into what Nehemiah's done, because look at what he's doing. He's building a wall, he's setting up defenses. I don't know, maybe it does look like this is what he's doing. But unlike other people who we've just mentioned, like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, who are saved by Hashem overtly, here, Nehemiah actually first davens, and then he takes care of the defense himself. There's a particular threat by someone named Shemaiah, who may be identified here as a false prophet. He says that Nehemiah is going to be the king. Malbim actually suggests that Nehemiah takes Shemaiah seriously because he's saying Nehemiah is going to be the king, that Nehemiah has some kind of ambition in this regard. But he tells Nehemiah to stay in the Heichal, inside the Beis HaMikdash. It's unclear whether he's trying to make him sin. Would this have been a transgression? Is he trying to frighten him? Does he want to give him a reputation as a coward? Is he trying to create a public impression of an alliance with him? We give all sorts of different explanations, but the bottom line is Nehemiah will not take the bait. He refuses. He defeats all the attempts on him. Chapter 7. Okay, so we're still building the wall. We have defenses up. We've dealt with the economy, we've dealt with assaults on Nehemiah, now we talk about the Olim, and this is the chapter I've mentioned before as a problem, or one of the chapters I've mentioned as a problem, in terms of chronology. It begins, simply enough, Nehemiah assigning guards for the walls, the construction is now done. But then we mention the problem of a diminished Jerusalem. The population is not large enough for the city. People don't want to live there, maybe because it's always under attack. We talked about why people might not want to live there, but the bottom line is you need people to move in. The city's going to be very hard to defend. So Nehemiah is going to assign 10% of the population to live in Yerushalayim. So he takes a census. But in the text, he reproduces the original census from Ezra chapter 2. Maybe to show pride in those who came initially, to show the evolution of the nation since then. There are some differences between the addition in Ezra chapter 2 and Nehemiah chapter 7. The Gemara reads that as intentional. It's teaching me lessons. Metudat David says it's because some people have left, some people have arrived. The Malbim says that the new list includes people who came from other areas besides the capital city of Babel. All sorts of different explanations. It is unclear, when I say Nehemiah chapter 7 reproduces Ezra chapter 2 with its census, it's unclear whether only the census is brought in from earlier times or whether the events of the next few chapters also come from that earlier time of Zerubbabel, again reawakening the question of Zerubbabel and Nehemiah. However you slice it, Nehemiah chapters 8 through 10 present religious renaissance, a great big public Torah reading, the celebration of Rosh Hashanah, the celebration of Sukkot, a great public prayer, and the establishment of a religious constitution. All of that is coming here in chapters 8 to 10 of Nehemiah. Then you wonder why it took us so long to finish this. So, Nehemiah chapter 8, the people request a public Torah reading. Ezra does it. It's on Rosh Hashanah at Shar Hamayim, the water gate. Literally, that's where they brought water for the water celebration on Sukkot, Simchas Beis HaShoeva. However, worth noting, it's also where Ezra's contemporary Zechariah prophesied that water is going to come from the Beis HaMikdash in the time of Mashiach, which is a sign of life, a sign of hope. So maybe that's why he does it there. Either way, he reads from the Torah, and the people start crying when the Torah is read. It may be because of general guilt, in the sense of we're not living up to it. Malbim suggests it's because the reading that he read was specifically the Rosh Hashanah reading, and it marked the day as Yom HaDin. How we know Rosh Hashanah is Yom HaDin is a great discussion, not for right now. But he marked Rosh Hashanah as the day of judgment for them, and that's why they cried. It's the day of judgment, oh no! And Nehemiah says don't. He says don't cry, eat, share rich foods with those who don't have any, and do not be sad. He says don't be upset. This is Rosh Hashanah, we are celebrating. Then we find out, they read from the Torah, and lo and behold, there's a mitzvah of Sukkot. And the text seems to indicate that they're surprised that there is this thing called Sukkot. Also, it says you haven't had one since Yehoshua. What in the world are you talking about? David HaMelech didn't build a sukkah. So in terms of the surprise, some read the text to indicate that there is no surprise. They don't see anything about surprise in the text. They're not surprised by Sukkot. Others accept that there is surprise. The Kuzari says it's the rank and file. Yeah, the leaders did it, the good people did it, and some people didn't do it. The Rashba says the bulk of the city, in fact, weren't celebrating all along. What about the statement that there hasn't been a sukkah since Yehoshua? So Rabbah gives the simple answer. He says it's in terms of religious fervor. There hadn't been a sukkah with this kind of excitement. The Gemara in Erechin says it's about creating new Kedusha. Erchalam Adbeis, the creating new Kedusha with the sanctification of the land, or he then floats off with an entirely different discussion that you'll have to see there and go back to the Shiurim on chapter 8 of Nehemiah. The Malbim has a creative approach. He says it's about having a sukkah on public land, because there is a lot of stress here about the fact that they built their sukkot in these public places. He says they didn't do that beforehand. Now they have a new enactment. This is what you can do. So, after Sukkot, chapter 9 now, after Sukkot, and according to the Talmud Yerushalmi, after Isru Chag as well, they fast and they do tshuva. So now, all the things they were upset about in Rosh Hashanah, now they can make good on them. They separate from foreigners, indicating there's been intermarriage. either because Ezra didn't succeed in separating everybody out, or because the practice resumed after him, or if you say this took place earlier in history, in the time of Zerubbabel, it's before Ezra separated everybody, perhaps. There's an extended tefillah, an extended davening, part of which makes it into Psukei Dezimra, the morning davening, details our national history. The Yerushalmi in Brachos says that it's written by the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. But the main focus of this prayer is to highlight Hashem's hand in our history. The fact that Hashem saves us, the fact that Hashem punishes us. The goal may also be to connect us back in time to our roots for authenticity purposes. That's another possibility. Rav Adin Steinsaltz offers another possibility. He says it's a preamble for the constitution that's coming for us in Chapter 10. Because Chapter 10 does indeed present a national pact which cements the tshuva that was seen in the previous two chapters. They make a big document. The leaders sign the document. Rav Yoel Ben Nun thinks these leaders are the members of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the Great Assembly. The document states a general acceptance of Torah, but it also says we commit to end intermarriage, we commit to observe Shabbat, we commit to observe agricultural law, we commit to support the Beit HaMikdash and the tribe of Levi. Some suggest that the reason why you need these commitments is that these are all rabbinic extensions of the biblical law or caveats on the biblical law. Could be. We also see here that the Kohanim collect tithes with the Levium at the end of the chapter. And Tosfos thinks that that's the basis for what we said earlier, the Gemara in Yevamos, that Ezra shifted the tithe, the Meister tithe, from the Kohanim, from the Levium to the Kohanim being able to collect, in punishment for the Levium not showing up originally for, when he called them, for the Beis HaMikdash. Okay. So that's chapters 8, 9, and 10, this religious renaissance. Rosh Hashanah, Torah reading, Sukkah celebration, national constitution. And now, finally, chapters 11 and 12 return to the story of Jerusalem. Remember, we needed to populate it back in chapter 7. They did a census. They brought in the census from Ezra chapter 2. So in chapter 11, they designate 10% of the population, a tithe. Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, chapter 37 of Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, says that Levi is identified to work in the Beis HaMikdash because it's a tithe of the nation. Well, now we get a tithe of the population to live in Jerusalem. And we list the leaders who live in Jerusalem. These may be part of the 10% or they may be volunteers. It's unclear. We list the residents who are from Yehuda and Binyamin, although there may be some who are there from other tribes as well. These are the dominant ones. Then in chapter 12, we get a census of the tribe of Levi by clan and their shifts. They work in the Beis HaMikdash. They consecrate the wall of the city, meaning they consecrate the city itself, although there's a debate as to whether they had everything they needed for the consecration and it was proper, or whether this was merely symbolic. And then finally, we get the height, the peak of Ezra and Nehemiah. The people bring their tithes to Yerushalayim, to Jerusalem, because they want to do so. Because the tribe of Levi are doing their jobs. And finally, they have a Beis HaMikdash, and it's functioning, and it's a Kiddush Hashem, it's a sanctification of God's name, and isn't it wonderful? And you could just end your book here. But then you get Perek Yud-Gimel, chapter 13. And in chapter 13, Nehemiah goes back to Persia. There are a few different ways to read the opening 9 verses of chapter 13. I'm taking one route, because this is the route that I think fits very well. I think this was Malbim's route, if I remember correctly. So Nehemiah goes back to Persia, but then he comes back to Judea. Why? After how long? We don't know. He finds Tovia the Ammoni housed in the Beis HaMikdash, and the major elements of the constitution, intermarriage, Shabbos, the tithes, are ignored. Nehemiah acts, and in particular, he targets the national leadership. He holds a public Torah reading, which stresses the prohibition against marrying Ammon and Moab. Remember, Tovia is an Ammoni. He then separates the marriages by force. He cites here, I mentioned earlier that Shlomo was important to him. He cites Shlomo HaMelech. He cites King Solomon. I forgot to note, he kicks out Tovia from the Beis HaMikdash. But he cites Shlomo HaMelech. He says, what are you doing intermarrying? You know, when Shlomo married these foreign wives, they led him astray. Now, whether Shlomo married foreign wives or whether they converted, we discussed from the Rambam. But the bottom line is that Shlomo was the national height to which Nehemiah seems to aspire. in Malachim Aleph, Perek Yud, Kings 1, Chapter 10, Shlomo achieves this great height where all the nations respect us, and we have a temple, and people come from afar to hear his wisdom. That's, I think, what Nehemiah is going for. And so he says to them, you know, Shlomo fell from his heights because of intermarriages. Why would you want to fall in the way that he did? He kicks out Tovia, he separates them, he separates the intermarriages, the whole bit. He also locks the city gates on Shabbos, and he orders the merchants not to dare return on Shabbos. Our tradition sees in his decree the statement of the laws, or the origin of the laws of Muktzah as well. And he reinstates tithe collection at the Beis HaMikdash. And each time he does something in this restoration of the platform, he declares to Hashem proudly, I have not capitulated, we succeeded in reinstating the Constitution. He's still trying to attain that height, that national glory. And that returns to the major point of Ezra Nehemiah, tracking the events of our national history en route to our successful return to our land, a legitimate Jewish state with Hashem's orchestration. That's really what these books have been all about. One final note, this is from a piece that I heard from Rabbi Angel, Rabbi Chaim Angel, in an audio shiur years ago. He says, you know, we end Tanakh with Dibra HaYamim. If you look at the Gemara Bava Basra, Yadalit Tesvav, it gives you the order in which the books are supposed to be presented in Tanakh. And for Ksuvim, Tuvim, it gives them in chronological order, but it ends with Dibra HaYamim, and that's very strange. Dibra HaYamim, Chronicles, is not the end chronologically. Dibra HaYamim ends with Ezra beginning. If you don't remember that, listen to the shiur from 48 minutes ago. The story began, the Ezra began at the end of Dibra HaYamim. So why not do Dibra HaYamim, Ezra, Nehemiah? So he suggested it's because Nehemiah doesn't have a happy ending. Dibra HaYamim ends beautifully. And then Koresh said, whoever wants to go up to God to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, go. Isn't that wonderful? That's a nice ending. As opposed to, you know, I came back to town and what a mess I found, and here I tried to restore everything I had. Nehemiah doesn't have an unambiguously happy ending, because things have collapsed. At the same time, Nehemiah is trying to save them. Nehemiah is trying to restore everything. It's the human being doing the best he can to try to install order. And to me, you know, that fits very well with everything that we've been trying to do ever since. Thank you very much for listening. I hope this was somewhat helpful. I think for people who are there for the 2 years, it's helpful. For anyone who's just randomly popped into this year, maybe it'll be an incentive to go back and catch the other 59. I don't know. But hopefully this is helpful for somebody. I look forward to continuing in the fall, God willing, with Yeshaya. Thank you.